In 1991, this tranquil pond in rural Connecticut was the scene of a horrific crime. Two young boys were beaten, thrown into the water, and left for dead. Investigators had little evidence until they examined the pond itself and found thousands of clues, invisible to the naked eye, in a simple drop of water. Waterford, a small Connecticut town where the water table is so high, homes are built around numerous small ponds and lakes. In 1991, two boys, we'll call Stephen and Bobby, decided to spend their afternoon fishing at their favorite spot, Stenger's Pond.
Oh, that's pretty good.
I told you.
Sometime later, they were approached by three older boys they didn't know. Without warning, one pulled a knife. The other two threw Stephen and Bobby to the ground. Stephen tried to fight back, but was hit on the head with a baseball bat, almost knocking him unconscious. Both boys had their hands and feet bound with duct tape and their mouths covered. Once out in the pond, Stephen was hit once again and held underwater so that he would drown. Bobby was next. Fortunately, he saw the bat coming and ducked, then pretended to be unconscious. After throwing Stephen and Bobby's fishing rods in the water, they took the boys' bicycles and fled. Bobby was able to remove the duct tape from his hands, mouth, and feet. He swam to Stephen to try and save him. By the time he got there, Stephen was unconscious. Bobby managed to get him to shore, then carried him a quarter mile to the nearest home. Deborah Chamberlain heard a frantic knocking at her door.
Oh my God, what happened?
One had a serious head wound and was not very coherent, and the other was just almost hysterical. And so I knew that something awful had happened to the two boys, and that would be something that we would sort out over the next couple of minutes. But I think the duct tape was really almost my first impression, because I thought, oh my God, someone tape their wrists together.
Stephen was rushed to the emergency room of Lawrence and Memorial Hospital. Dr. John Urbanetti was Stephen's doctor.
Despite the number of people that I've seen with this kind of circumstance, he came as close as I've ever seen anyone come to not surviving.
As Stephen lay in intensive care, doctors questioned whether he would live or die. And Waterford police had questions of their own. Who had tried to murder Stephen and Bobby? And why? Waterford police detective Donald McCarthy was assigned to investigate the assault and attempted murder of the two young boys at Stenger's Pond. 13-year-old Stephen was fighting for his life, the victim not only of an attempted drowning, but of massive head wounds.
One of the doctors had told one of my detectives at the time that it was the closest he had ever seen anybody come to drowning and not being dead.
He was very lucky. The older child was unconscious. Had he not had his little friend with him, he probably would have drowned, I think.
Stephen's friend Bobby had escaped serious injury.
I think the remarkable thing is he had the presence of mind to immediately go to his friend and pull his friend from the water.
There's no doubt in our minds, if he did not remove that duct tape, the older male would have died if he did not remove him from that body of water.
When he came to the door, the little guy, amazingly, was quite a bit smaller than his friend, was just literally supporting him completely.
Police went to Stenger's pond to collect evidence, but they ran into a major obstacle. The crime scene was a body of water.
The fishing poles, the tackle box, the suspects had tried to sanitize the crime scene by throwing those items in the water so that the police would not recover them, making it difficult that the fact that they were submerged in water, we would not, normally not have fingerprints available to us.
The bat used as the weapon was found floating in a nearby sewer grate, but there were no fingerprints. And any other possible evidence, such as hairs and fibers, had apparently been washed into the water. Police talked to residents of the neighborhood closest to Stenger's pond to see if they had seen anything unusual. Susan Picardi came forward to say that earlier on the day of the attack, a young teenager she had never seen before came to her door asking for help.
Can I help you?
Yeah, I was walking down the street when I began to feel a little lightheaded and hungry. May I come in and get something to eat?
He said he wasn't feeling well. He was a diabetic and was in need of something, whether it was sugar or orange juice or a piece of chocolate or something. I immediately felt bad for him and invited him in.
Why don't you come in and have a seat, and I'll get you some fruit juice.
Thanks.
Mrs. Picardi gave the young man a glass of orange juice. A few minutes later, he said he was feeling better, thanked her, and left.
Because I can call a doctor.
No, I'm fine. Thanks.
Later, as Mrs. Picardi was about to take a shower, she saw something unusual in her bathroom mirror.
And I caught the image of what was going on in my backyard from upstairs. And I saw two other youngsters in the corner of my yard, teenagers, 16-ish, around there. A redheaded boy and another Afro-American young man.
And they were later joined by the young man who just left Mrs. Picardi's home.
She gave me orange juice. She treated me so nice.
The boys had a bright green baseball bat and what looked like rolls of duct tape.
I automatically panicked and knew whatever they had planned was not going to happen at my house. So I yelled out the window to them, I think you better leave. It's obvious that you're planning something or you're up to trouble, and I'm calling the police. So if you know what's good for you, then you better get going.
Susan Picardi was able to provide a detailed description of the boy who'd come to her door.
Mr. Picardi told us two things that stood out. One, he was wearing eyeglasses and described those eyeglasses to us. The other was he had an unusual shaped scar, a U-shaped ray scar, on his forearm.
Since the perpetrators were apparently on foot, police checked the neighborhoods nearest to Stenger's pond.
We put officers in that neighborhood and started doing neighborhood canvasses in that based on the description of the three suspects. As a result, we were able to identify the suspect immediately.
This suspect, 17-year-old Brian Davis, had the upraised scar described by Susan Picardi. Neighborhood informants identified the two friends Davis spent the most time with. One was 17-year-old Christopher Green. The other was an African-American juvenile whom we'll call Jason. All three suspects fit the descriptions provided by Susan Picardi, but denied they were involved in the assault. In Christopher Green's house, police found a knife like the one Bobby had told them about. In Green's basement, they found a pair of wet, muddy sneakers.
We inquired of the suspect, why are these things wet? And he was trying to tell us that it was as a result of walking through mud puddles and things like that. As soon as he said that, we started working on a theory that, how do we attack this? He's coming up with a defense. This is how my clothes got wet. I was playing in mud puddles and things like this.
Was the mud on Green's sneakers from Stenger's pond? And if so, how could scientists prove it? For the answers, police turned to a new type of forensic science, one that had never before been used in a criminal case anywhere in the world. Thirteen-year-old Stephen, the oldest of the two boys who were assaulted and left for dead in Stenger's pond, was in intensive care for a week. His condition gradually improved. He was extremely fortunate. Doctors found no evidence of permanent injury.
Fortunately, he'd had an episode that was short enough so that he suffered no permanent injury to his brain. But during the time of recovery, he needed a fair amount of intensive care support.
Police had three suspects in custody: Brian Davis, Christopher Green, and the juvenile we'll call Jason. All denied any involvement in the attacks. Brian Davis and Jason had no prior brushes with the law, but Christopher Green had a long history of petty offenses and small-time violence. Police took the sneakers from Green's basement, but no one was sure if the mud on the soles could be used as evidence.
We had the shoes. How do we find out now, find someone who's going to tell us what to do with this?
You understand exactly what it is we're trying to do.
Waterford police spent weeks calling around the country, looking for someone who might be able to help. The FBI told them of a scientist at nearby Connecticut College.
Here we are, we're going all over the United States. Connecticut College is 5 minutes from our police station.
The scientist was Dr. Peter Siver, a forensic limnologist, an expert on microscopic life in freshwater environments. Dr. Siver was asked to find out if the mud on Green's sneakers came from Stenger's pond. He took the mud from the sneakers and added a mixture of sulfuric acid and potassium dichromate, which removed the dirt, leaving behind only the life forms that may have existed in the water. It's a world invisible to the naked eye.
Inside that small drop of water exists literally hundreds of different organisms. They come in all different arrays, all different shapes, all different colors. And it's an entirely different world underneath that one drop of water.
And what Dr. Siver found were diatoms, microscopic single-cell organisms, a form of algae. Each diatom is housed in an incredibly complex structure made up of silica or glass.
I would say that diatoms are pieces of art. They're pieces of art because each diatom can make exactly the same pattern each time it makes a new cell. And these patterns are very ornate. They're highly artistic in their look.
While diatoms may be art, they can also be pieces of evidence. Any body of water has hundreds, if not thousands, of species of diatoms. The types of diatoms and how many exist of the various species is unique to that body of water.
In any given water body, you can essentially examine the microscopic organisms and, in effect, create a fingerprint for that water body.
On the sneakers, Dr. Siver found large numbers of one type of diatom known as Eunotia. Shown here, Eunosha are characterized by the crescent shapes of their glass shells. There were three species of Eunosha on the suspect's sneakers, and they were there in unusually high concentrations. And Dr. Seiver found one more clue. He found what's known as a scaled chrysophyte. Scaled chrysophytes are related to diatoms, but unlike diatoms, they can swim. There was only one species of chrysophyte in the mud, Malamonas caudata, shown here magnified 2,000 times. When Dr. Seiver analyzed the water samples from Stenger's pond, he found the same high concentrations of Eunosha and the same species of scaled chrysophyte. The fingerprint of the water at Stenger's pond was the same as the sample on the sneakers of Christopher Green. This was the break police had been counting on.
One thing that we found is there's always a scientist out there. As off the wall as it may sound, or what you're trying to accomplish, we have found there's always somebody out there that will listen to you.
Christopher Green, Brian Davis, and Jason were arrested and charged with assault and attempted murder. But the question now turned to motive. Why did they attack the two young boys? And was there another intended victim that day? Forensic scientists found a way to prove that one of the suspect's sneakers had been in the water at Stenger's pond, where the two young boys had been assaulted and left for dead.
I think the physical evidence in this case was just overwhelming. The diatoms and the pond evidence, or the aquatic evidence, whatever way you want to use it, was just devastating. And I think the defense attorneys realized that.
The forensic analysis showed that when Christopher Green went into the water to strike his victims, he got mud on his shoes, mud that contained the microscopic fingerprint of the water in Stenger's pond. The diatoms in that mud clearly tied him to the crime scene.
For me, I thought it was unique and unusual because it's something that you normally don't read about in textbooks.
Even though Stephen and Bobby's bicycles were stolen after the assault, police and prosecutors do not believe robbery was the motive.
These three kids, I am totally convinced, were on a mission that day. As a result of interviewing the three after their arrest, they went out to that day to look to kill somebody. There's no doubt in my mind.
Can I help you?
Yeah. Police believe that Susan Picardi was originally the intended victim. Brian Davis did not have diabetes, as he claimed, but only used it as an excuse to gain entry to her home.
Have a seat, and I'll get you some grape juice.
Thanks.
When he rejoined his accomplices in Susan's backyard, they may have been planning how to get into the house.
The real alarm bells went off when I went upstairs and I saw two boys in the corner of my yard. And then I sort of all put it together, and then I started feeling like I was just set up.
Fortunately, Susan Picardi saw them in her bathroom mirror and called the police. She looks back to that day and often wonders how close she was to danger.
A great way to describe it as a sixth sense. The mirror was in the right place. The kids were in the right place. It was meant to be for me to see them and to, just by their body language, understand that something is not right here.
Police determined that Christopher Green, the only one of the defendants with a history of violence, had instigated the attacks.
Christopher Green was probably the ringleader for the other two. He was the one that brought the bat. He was the one that brought the duct tape. He was the one that did the striking on our victims. He's the one that basically directed the other two.
Brian Davis and Christopher Green were both tried as adults and were sentenced to a minimum of 18 years in prison. Their 16-year-old accomplice, Jason, was only 2 weeks shy of his 17th birthday when he committed the crime. As a result, he was tried and convicted as a juvenile and was sentenced to spend time in the facility for young offenders. He has since been released. The microscopic diatom evidence on Christopher Green's sneakers, so simple in purpose, so magnificent in design, and so potent as evidence. For Waterford police and for law enforcement around the world, the case set a precedent.
It's a landmark case. It was the first time that this evidence, or evidence of an aquatic environment, meaning the diatoms, were used to place a suspect at a crime scene.
We found that it had never been used before. What was nice about it is they were willing to take it on and try it. And that was the key for us.
Shortly after this case, law enforcement in Switzerland solved the murder of a young boy using diatom evidence. The boy had drowned, and the species of diatoms in the victim's lungs matched the species of diatoms found on the gas pedal of the suspect's automobile. Both cases were solved because a group of Connecticut detectives had a hunch that some mud on the bottom of a shoe might tie a suspect to a crime.
I would never say give up being the old-fashioned, hard beaten the road cop, but you've got to be aware of the sciences that are there to help you. If you don't, you're beating yourself.
A lot of the thoughts that Lieutenant McCarthy came up with, we always thought were unusual, but 9 out of 10 times he was right. I have to say 99.8% of the time he was right.